As I said last time, today I want to concentrate on extensions and how to, or extension groups, and how to compute them. And I just want to make some remarks, so we'll fix A throughout an abelian category. And then we had defined x1 A x comma y. And let me just remind you that this is the equivalence classes of short exact sequences. Which sort of end in x and start in y. And the equivalence relation was that if you can fill in morphisms like this, so you take the identities at the two ends and something in the middle, then the class of this extension here, so call this extension E and this one E prime, then E, the class of E equals the class of E prime. So that concept makes sense in any abelian category as long as you have the notion of short exact sequences. You can talk about extensions in this manner. Now, what we saw is, so just to recall that x1 a can be considered as a functor in both arguments. So then it goes from the opposite category in a. It's contravariant in the first argument, covariant in the second, and it takes values, well, first of all, in abelian groups or even in k-modules if a is a K category. In other words, if there is a natural action through elements from the commutative ring K on each Hom set, then this action persists on the extension groups. We also said that it is, so first of all, it's a functor, bifunctor, sometimes called. It is additive in each argument. It is half exact, a notion I didn't define yet, but what it means is, so if you have a functor between abelian categories, so functor between abelian categories, then one says that F is exact and we have the following notion. So F is exact means that for any exact sequence 0, A to B to C, the induced sequence is again exact. Now, of course, the first sequence is exact, so short exact sequence in A. Well, shouldn't have used A here. Maybe I'll underline it. And then this sequence here is, again, exact, but this time, of course, in the target, in the category B. One says that F is left exact if only, well, it's exact, you have exactness at the left end, this is exact, and this means the same thing as to say that F of A is a kernel for the morphism from F of B to F of C. Now, I'm pretty sure I don't have to tell you what right exactness means. So there you have just the zero is maintained at the other end. And so that simply means that F of C is the co-kernel of the induced map from F of A to F of B. And finally, F is half exact if only the morphism, so if there are no zeros at the end. And so what, if this is exact, what does that mean? Well, this means that the image of F of A is isomorphic to the kernel of F of B to F of C, or equivalently, that the co-kernel of the morphism from F of A to F of B is isomorphic to the image of F of B. Now, we had, or at least I stated it without giving a full proof, we had even more than half exactness. Namely, we had, so if we have zero, let's say we fix some x in our category, and then if we have an exact sequence, 0 to A to B to C to 0, then we get an exact sequence, hom from X to A to hom from X to B, hom A, X to C, and then it continues with X1A, XA, X1A, XB, and X1A, XC, and I said, and I'm going to get back to this in a second, that it even continues if you look at the higher extension. So not only, so half exactness simply means that, so half exactness in the second argument just means that these composition of these two arrows is exact in this sense there. So this means, so exactness inside these orange brackets means that X1AX, so where you fix the first argument, is half exact. And I'll let you to write down the corresponding statements, so analogously, when has that X A is the first argument open is half exact. Now, of course, this is a contravariant functor, so you interpret these notions of exactness, left exact, right exact, half exact, on the opposite category. So let me just mention it here to make sure everything is defined. Now, we'll come to the role of this long exact sequence, which is, I think, is in some sense sort of the key content of homological algebra, namely the first thing that you can extend these homomorphism groups to the right, and also that you have an effective description of what should come here, and we also will see that in a sense this is a minimal extension. In other words, if you have any way of extending the sequence of the Homs to the right, with certain properties of course, then the minimal way to do so is through the extension groups. So they're fairly unique and important. So before going on to this, I just want to make this remark about the higher extensions, and there I won't be able to prove everything because it's quite laborious, because you have to check a lot of things. But still, let me state what is going on. So, well, first of all, we say an N extension of X by Y is simply an exact sequence which has N middle terms. So exactness in the same sense as before. So if we call these maps, let's say alpha 0, alpha 1, alpha n, so then exactness of such a sequence simply means that the kernel of alpha I is equal to the image of alpha I minus 1 for I running from 0 to n, actually to n plus 1, where, of course, the convention is that alpha minus 1 is 0. This is this unique map here, if you like, and alpha n plus 1 is a unique map there. So that means exactness at that here at y simply means that alpha 0 is a monomorphism. And simply, similarly, exactness at X means that alpha N is an epimorphism. Now, there is an addition namely, if we have two such gadgets. No. Well, I'm going to define the addition first and then the equivalent, and then say that the equivalent is compatible with addition. So if we have, first of all, what's sometimes called the external addition. So if you have two such N extensions, so these are N extensions, then, and that's pretty trivial, you can just take direct sums everywhere, and the morphisms will just be the direct sums of the morphisms. So this is, again, an N extension. There's nothing really to be said here. And also we have functoriality, namely, if we have any morphism, say, at the right end, into the object at the right end, well, let me write out just a few terms, then we'll do the same thing as we did for one extensions. In other words, we form the pullback. So that is Zn cross X prime over X. That comes equipped with a natural projection. And the key issue is that the kernel of alpha n is isomorphic to the kernel of alpha n prime. So that we already used when we discussed functoriality of the one extensions, but mind you that the kernel of alpha n is the image of Zn minus 1. So we simply can keep Zn minus 1 here and map it onto the kernel of alpha n prime, which is after all the same as the kernel of alpha n. And so we simply only change this little square here, and the rest we keep the same. And so if this is the extension E, then we define this to be F upper star of E. And also, we said that the pullback of an epimorphism is an epimorphism, so we get exactness here. And exactness here was just this fact, and the exactness at the to the left of it is just the same as the exactness before. Thus, we see that F upper star, well, transforms n extensions in n extensions, and of course there is a dual version, namely if you do it on the other side, so you take a morphism from Y to Y prime, then you perform the pushout. Let's call this G, which gives you Y prime direct sum Z1 divided out by Y, or equivalently, just to remind you, this can be identified as the co-kernel of Y maps into Y prime plus Z1 through the two morphisms, which did I call this one alpha 0. So this is just G, comma, alpha 0. Then again, dually to what we had before, the induced map alpha 0 prime up here will be a monomorphism, and moreover, the co-kernels of alpha naught and alpha naught prime will be isomorphic, so I can simply continue as I did before. And so I had my n extension here, and I get a new one, which is called G lower star of E, which you get by just pushing out along G, the leftmost term. So that means that's the functoriality. And so if we have two extensions, n extensions, let's say E and E prime of X by Y, then we define the addition simply as follows. We first take the external direct sum of E and E prime, so just take direct sums at each place, and then we have the diagonal for X, so where the diagonal from X is the map from X into X plus X, which comes uniquely from the fact that X plus X direct sum with X is a product of X with itself. Similarly, we have the co-diagonal from Y plus Y to Y, also sometimes called the sum map. And so we can take the push forward with respect to that. And as you see, if you follow these three constructions, so this is, again, an N extension of X by Y. And again, this is called the bare sum of the two extensions. Even though Reinhold Baer, as far as I know, only did it for abelian groups, and that only for X1s. But of course, the construction is precisely the same. And then, Yoneda, I think this is goes. This is really. That's Yoneda's paper in 1960 or so. Yeah, so he showed that this whole machinery of the X works in any abelian category and just is purely formal. You don't need to know anything except for these basic operations here. So, now, one convinces oneself, so that's a simple exercise, is first of all, well, maybe three exercises here. You see, it doesn't matter, in general, these two operations, pull back on the right and push out on the left commute. Doesn't matter which one you do first. So, G lower star of F upper star of E is the same thing as F upper star of G lower star of E. And what do I mean here by isomorphism? When are two extensions isomorphic? Well, if you have one and another one by the same extended by extensions of the same object, then they are isomorphic if you can fill in the middle by isomorphisms. So we'll say that E and E prime are isomorphic, so this requires isos at each step. So in particular, you see here the sum does not depend on whether you first pull back along the diagonal of X and then push forward by the co-diagonal or sum map for Y. You could do it the other way around. So to continue with the exercises, one has that E plus E prime is isomorphic to E prime plus E. So in other words, this operation is commutative, and it is also associative. So you have E plus E prime plus E double prime is isomorphic to E plus E prime plus E double prime. Again, this is sort of more or less straightforward. It just uses the properties of pullbacks and pushouts. However, what is not so clear is the equivalence relation. And that's a little bit trickier than for one extensions. Namely, you say that sort of E is equivalent to E prime if you have, which at first glance looks the same as for one extensions, namely, so here you have E, say, here we have E prime, and you have the identities on the outside, but arbitrary maps in between. So this is a, if you like, so here we said, let's see, so here we had alpha 0 and alpha n, and let's say here we have beta 0, beta n, and so this we'll call them gamma 1 up to gamma n. So what it means is then that each of these squares commutes, but you do not insist that the gamma i's are isomorphisms. So gamma I, any morphisms such that all squares commute. In the case of one extension, so where n equals 1, the fact that you have isomorphisms at the end forces the unique one in the middle to be an isomorphism. But that's no longer true if your extensions are longer. Here's an example. Let's see. let's say you take Z2, you embed it into Z4. So here's multiplication by 2 in the middle. And then you get a 2 extension of Z2 by Z2. And I claim that you can do the same thing with Z8, but now you multiply by 4, you get a 2 extension of Z2 by Z2, and, well, I claim that these two extensions are equivalent, because here you take simply the projection from Z8 to Z4, and am I doing this right here? Yeah, and so here, yeah, of course, here we'll just take multiplication. Should be okay. So here we take n mod 8, send it to 4n mod 8 here, and then send it to, which would be 0, right? Oh, yeah. See, commutativity in this, in the middle, well, this map is 0, right? Because you have a multiple of 4, which goes to 0. But then if you go around this way, you get 0 as well, because you end up again with a multiple of 4. So both, so this square commutes, except that it isn't, not very interesting, because the both compositions are 0. And so, well, I was hesitant so that I don't get myself into a mess here, but clearly what you do here, so here 2 goes to 2 mod 8, and so if you multiply it by 2, what am I doing here? Did it the wrong way around, huh? So the generator here goes to 4. So wouldn't this one wouldn't commute, right? Okay, so what is the kernel here of this map? That's just Z mod 4. Right, the multiples of 2. Here, the kernel is, again, the multiples of 2. So, what is a... No, because we want that the... of course, yes. Yes. Right. Yes, of course. Yeah. So, then these commutes, but of course, neither this one nor this one are isomorphisms. So, that makes it a little bit tricky, because this means that this notion of equivalence relation is not symmetric. because there's no way, and you could try it, but I would be surprised. Well, you can easily see that there is no way you could map this, the top extension, to the bottom one. Because, well, how can you map Z4 to Z8? Well, the only way is by multiplication by 2, but then you get 0 out here. So this one doesn't even exist. So this is a problem with this notion. So this, or maybe I should call it not equivalent, I'll just call it pre-equivalent. And so, but then once you have any kind of binary relations, and there's a unique way to make it into an equivalence relation. So, and I did indicate it some time ago. So if you have two extensions, E and E prime, well, how can you make them equivalent? Well, you would like to say if you have a morphism between them as here. Well, we just saw this doesn't make sense. So instead, you say, well, there should be a zigzag like this. And then you have something here and a morphism there. So where this is sort of a pre-equivalence. So we'll say that E and E prime are equivalent if there exists such a zigzag of pre-equivalences. Yes, this one is minimal in the sense, you see, if you have any binary relation, and let's call it smaller or equal.
No, sorry. I don't think I understood. I mean, is there an extension which maps into all those that are equivalent to it?
Yeah.
Or the other way?
Yes. Often there are. And that's a good case, but not always. And we'll see this in a moment. Yes, sometimes there are sort of, you see, you can also see what your question amounts to. So what Dorr is basically saying is, so given an equivalence class of such exact sequences, is there an initial object? Is there an exact sequence in the same class which maps to all the others, so which sits sort of at the bottom? Or is there one at the top so that all others map to it? And the answer is, yes, there is a minimal one, an initial object, if your abelian category has enough projective objects. There is a top one if you have enough injective objects. But in general, the answer is no. No. Well, no, the final one in this case happens to be this. So, yes, but that's a bit trickier. I'll show you later how it looks like. Because it involves, well, not in the, you see, as you can immediately see from this morphism, it will not exist if you insist that all terms are finite groups. Because you can, of course, sort of by powers of two, you can go back. You can take Z16 and so on and map into these. But what you can do is if you map, put Q mod Z, then it works. So, in other words, well, you even only would need the two torsion part of that. But in a sense, you can see it from this picture. What would be the bottom one? The bottom one is the inverse limit over these cyclic groups of power, two-power order, if you want to have a chance, because this definitely sits beneath any of these. It's not clear that it is a minimal one, right? Okay, so, and so here's the theorem. And so this is basically Yoneda's result, which says that if you define xn from x to y to be n extensions of x by y modulo equivalence, well, first of all, this is an abelian group with addition induced by bare sums. In other words, the construction of the sum of two extensions, as I explained it here, is compatible with the equivalence relation. Furthermore, of course, it is functorial in each argument. Well, maybe I should tell you what is the zero object in there. The zero object is represented by any extension 0, y, z1, alpha 0, with either alpha 0 a split mono, or alpha n a split epi. Of course, there might be a lot others, but if you want to make sure your long extension corresponds to a trivial class, it's the easiest to exhibit under this equivalence relation one in the same class which has either of the two n's being a split map. And notice that for one extensions, for n equals 1, these two are the same. In other words, 0 to y to z to x to 0, alpha 0, alpha 1, represents the trivial class if it is a direct sum extension. And remember that meant there exists maps beta 1 from x to z and beta naught from z to y, such that we have alpha 1, beta 1 equals the identity on x. We have alpha 0, no, beta 0, alpha 0 is the identity on y, and beta 1, alpha 1 plus alpha naught, beta naught is the identity on z. So for short exact sequences, this is very simple. It just means that you have the so-called split extension. Because it doesn't matter whether you say the left morphism or the right morphism splits. If one does, the other does automatically. But that's not true if you have longer extensions. It could very well happen that this one splits and this one doesn't. It's too far apart to see really from one end to the other what happens. Okay, so we had... Here's an abelian group. The zero object is this. It's functorial in each argument. It is half exact in each argument. And moreover, one has what I alluded to earlier. So moreover, for any X and A in any short exact sequence, zero to A to B to C to zero, one has a long exact sequence starting 0, hum, xA, hum, xB, hum, xC, into x1. Let me write it slightly differently. Put it like this, into x1, xA, x1, xB, x1, xc, and then it continues x2, xa, xi, xa, xi, xb, etc., and it can go on forever. Now, what I have to explain is, well, in each row here in this display, the maps are clear because of the functoriality. What is not so clear is how you go from one row to the next. Well, I explained it to you in the first instance. So if you had F in here, well, what you assigned it to is F upper star of this exact sequence. Right? This gives you an element in here. The class of F upper star of E, that's an element, that's a one extension. Just take the extension, pull it back by any morphism from X to C, and you get an extension from X by A. Now, what is the sort of, let's say, maybe, well, it doesn't really matter. Let me change the I to an N here, because we were talking about N extensions. Yeah, I dropped here the reference to the category everywhere. So what is the morphism which goes, say, from the Nth row to the N plus first row? Well, there isn't really so much choice, if you think about it. What's an element in here? Well, an element in here is a class of some, actually of many, N extensions, which start out with C at the left end and end with X on the right. And so, how do you, given the data, how do you construct out of this N extension an N plus 1 extension? Well, there's essentially only one way, namely, this here, the first map from C to whatever, Z1, is a monomorphism, but we had an exact sequence to begin with, which ended in C. So we simply can concatenate the n extension with a given exact sequence, and so we get sometimes called E, the concatenation with any n extension representing Z, and then you take the class in there. So where E union Z corresponds to 0, goes to A, goes to B, goes to Z1, and then it continues as it did before. So where, so this here, we called it what? Alpha 0, and let's call this A and B. So then this morphism here, the first one would be A, and the next one would be alpha 0, B, and the rest is the same. So you see that the on the level of objects and morphisms, these maps are really not very complicated to define. It's just sort of the obvious things you can do. Of course, it needs a little bit of work to prove the statement that this is a long exact sequence. And you can imagine that this will take a little while, especially because of the cumbersome nature of the equivalence relation. So, also I should mention, I wrote it down only for one argument, but of course there is the alternative version for the other argument. So for any x and any short exact sequence, one has a long exact sequence here. Finally, for any object y in A and the same exact short exact sequence as before, one has a long exact sequence where you sort of vary the other argument. So it will go from hom c to y to hom b to y. Right? Remember the first argument is contravariant, hom a to y. Into x1 cy x1 by x1 ay and so on ay. And so I write down the next term, and again I've left out the adornments here, the category where we work in. And again, there is really not much choice in defining these morphisms, namely, if you have a morphism G from A to Y, well, given that you have an extension from C by A, a one extension, how do you create a one extension from C by Y using G? Well, this, of course, is just G lower star of of the given exact sequence. And similarly, what do you do here in the nth row from the nth to the n plus first row? Well, again, just write down what you have. An element in Xn is a class of a short exact sequence of the type which goes from Y on the left to A on the right. Well, and you have an exact sequence which starts with A. And you simply concatenate at the other end. So, if you call this a class Z, or this call the, this whole sequence Z, and take a class of it, then the image here is simply you take the sequence, exact sequence Z, You concatenate it with E, and you take the class. And of course, the concatenated N plus 1 extension is the one you get by throwing out A and replacing it with a composition of these two. So this is the part of the extension theory that can be done barehand. You don't need to know anything about the abelian category. However, the problem, of course, is how do you calculate these guys? And just to, for good measure, let me mention once again that I ignored all the set theoretic problems which could arise from the fact that it is not even clear at this stage that the set of extensions is actually a set. In other words, that you can actually write down these terms. You might have to enlarge your universe to be able to do so. Okay, so how do we get at these things? And to do that, well, we first of all can make the following definition, for sure, which is sort of some measure for the size or complexity of the abelian category. Namely, we say, we define some A in the abelian category and we define the global dimension of A to be the maximum over all I, such that xi A is not identically zero. As a functor. So, equivalently, you can say it's a minimum I such that xi plus 1 xy equals 0 for all x and y. So, all I plus 1, beyond the global dimension, any extension of that length is trivial. Now, note, I mean, this includes the case so the global dimension of A may be infinite. Right? Because I said there's no reason, and in general it won't happen, that these long exact sequences ever stop. But you can also see that sort of it measures how far we are from linear algebra. Namely, here's an example. If A is the category of K vector spaces over some field K, then the global dimension of A is zero. Now, what does that mean? So in terms of the of Yoneda's theorem, we have to show that any n extension for n greater or equal to 1 is trivial. So, but let's look at this. Well, this is this exact sequence of vector spaces. Well, clearly, any surjection of vector spaces splits. Let's just take a basis of X and lift it back. So and for an extension of K vector spaces, alpha 0 is a split mono, alpha n is a split epi. Thus, the class is 0 in xn a xy. And so the fact, the basic fact of linear algebra is that any exact sequence splits, and that's just the same thing as to say that the theory of extensions is trivial, i.e. the global dimension of the category is 0, and that's when we are in the realm of linear algebra. So by the way, such a category is called semi-simple. So an abelian category of global dimension 0 is called semi-simple. Category of vector spaces is sort of the standard example. However, there are some more, and I'll give you two, let you choose what are the corresponding theorems. So here are two more examples. So example two, let K be again a field, n greater or equal to 1, a natural number, and consider A the category of modules over the n by n matrix ring over K. So these are the n by n matrices over K with usual addition and multiplication. And so claim is global dimension of A is 0. And that's just a sort of an anecdote as a side. I won't even write it down. But this here is a basis of quantum mechanics. Because when Heisenberg found the imprecision relation, people were very worried how you would start, how would you differentiate. So, yeah, uncertainty principle, yeah, or imprecision relation, right? That you cannot measure locus and momentum at the same time. People were very worried about the fact that how would you describe the evolution of a system, because for this you needed to differentiate with respect to time. But how do you do that if you have non-commuting variables? And in Heisenberg's original description, the non-commutativity was expressed by writing things in terms of matrices. And so there were two solutions found. One was by Born and Jordan, which if you read their paper nowadays, you can think of this as a precursor of cyclic homology, because this is exactly how they differentiate. They take a tensor, and then they take all the cyclic permutations and always differentiate the first factor. And that's precisely what you do. And the other one was Dirac. And what Dirac essentially noticed was that this category has global dimension 0 as well as a category of vector spaces, so there was no difference. You could express differentiation sort of internally in the category. I'm not going to explain that, but sort of used, what he used was a differentiation equals Lie bracket, and that is a consequence, although a rather involved one, of the fact that the global dimension of this abelian category is zero. So, just to tell you that something which looks pretty boring has some quite unexpected consequences. Now, if you were to prove this directly, well, good luck. Let me know. It's not completely obvious. No, as I said, no, I'm not going to go into this here. That will cost me too much time. Maybe I'll come back to it later. So this is a rather deep result. And nowadays one would say it's a consequence of what's called Morita equivalence. And perhaps we'll get there at some point. And let me just say, what is the reason why this is true? Well, the reason is pretty simple, namely, mod mn by n of k is equivalent to mod k. So in other words, the category of modules over the matrix algebra is the same, quote unquote, as a category of vector space. Now, if you have a pair of equivalences between, inverse equivalences between two abelian categories, then the global dimension of the two is the same. Why is that? Because, you see, I think I said that at some point, so assume that S and T are inverse equivalences. This implies that S and T are exact. Much more, because remember what it means is that if they're inverse equivalences, then they are adjoints. Each is the adjoint of the other on either side. In particular, they commute with all limits and co-limits. In particular, they're exact. But if they are exact, that means that the theory, or it means that x n a x y is the same as x n b s x s y. And the map in this direction is given by applying s to any exact sequence here, and the inverse is given by applying t to any exact sequence. But then you see that the global dimension of two equivalent categories is the same. Right? Because these groups are isomorphic. So if they vanish on the left, then they vanish on the right, and vice versa. So this is the sort of the reason why the category of modules over a matrix ring has the same global dimension as over the ring itself. Because this here has nothing to do with the field. So this is true for any ring K. Doesn't even have to be commutative. So that's sort of Morita's claim to fame, the observation that matrix rings behave exactly the same as the rings from where you start, homologically. Okay, so this is the second example. And the third example I want to give is what?
That the global dimension is zero.
No. What do you mean? First of all, what do you mean by the Heisenberg algebra?
The algebra generated by T and Q, so that T.
So that's a Weyl algebra.
What?
That's called the Weyl algebra. After Hermann Weyl, yes.
I thought it was Heisenberg.
No, the Heisenberg algebra is sort of. Well, it depends from it depends on the point of view, but you see the okay, that's a good point. Okay, so the Weyl algebra on n generators is called An, and so it is, you take your favorite field, let's say you take the complex numbers, you take two n variables, such modulo the relations that the p's commute among each other, the qi's commute among each other, and the commutator of pi qi, pi qj is delta ij. Huh? So this is called the nth Weyl algebra. And yes, indeed, the global dimension of An is not zero, but it's equal to n. So it's not quite as you want. What the Heisenberg algebra is essentially the same thing, except that you replace, you have one more variable, and the last, it's in the center, so Z is central, it commutes with everything. And you also have that the commutator of PIQJ is equal to delta IJ times Z. And what's the reason for this one? Well, you see, you think of Z as a parameter, like, for example, Planck's constant. And so if it's non-zero, then this algebra is the same as this. It's just a rescaling. Whether you make this commutator equal to 1 or to h or to epsilon, that doesn't matter. But if z is equal to 0, then you are in classical mechanics. So the limit, so if z is different from 0, you have quantum mechanics. If z is equal to 0, you have classical mechanics. And so the Heisenberg algebra gives you the transition from quantum mechanics to the classical limit. Yes? And the white gets... Yeah. Would you agree, Kentaro? Is this the standard? At least that's the way I know it. How physicists, do they call these things? We don't care too much. of this one? It's the same as this. Is this true? I mean, just think of it for a moment. No, it's larger. Yeah, it must be one. It's one larger than this one. Let me get back to you on this. I don't trust my own answer here. I'll think about it. No, it must be 2n plus 1, because z is a non-zero divisor in here, and if you divide it out, in other words, you set it equal to 0, you get the class, the polynomial ring, and 2n variables whose global dimension is 2n. And so this one will be one larger than that. So the global dimension of this is 2n plus 1. And so that's just a remark aside. The global dimension, this is, by the way, a very famous theorem by Hilbert. This is equal to n for k a field. Or, nowadays, you could even sort of be fancier. You could say that the global dimension of the polynomial ring, so commuting variables, over the coefficients increases the global dimension by n. But this is called Hilbert-Syzygy theorem. The statement of Hilbert-Syzygy theorem in these terms is that the global dimension of the polynomial ring in n variables over a field is n. And by the way, it doesn't really matter whether you take polynomials. The same is true if you take formal power series or you take convergent power series, let's say, if you are over a valued field like the complex numbers. So if you take germs of analytic functions in n variables, the global dimension is n as well. But these are pretty deep theorems. Nothing obvious about those. But now I've got off track because I'm at much larger global dimension than I wanted to be. What I wanted to say was a third example of a global dimension zero, so the semi-simple case. The global dimension of the exterior algebra is infinite. The global dimension of the Clifford algebra is finite, and right. So if you have a non-degenerate quadratic form, then the Clifford algebra is isomorphic to matrix algebra over a field, so it's global dimension zero. Oh, yeah, if it's not algebraically closed, but that doesn't matter. Yeah, so, okay, thank you. So this is, I didn't want this to be a certain example, but yes, so if you have Q from V to K, the quadratic form, so for those of you who have seen this ever before, a non-degenerate quadratic form, then there is a thing called the Clifford algebra, of Q, and the global dimension of this is equal to zero, and the reason is simply that it is a matrix algebra, because this Clifford algebra, I won't even give the formal definition, but it is the matrix ring. It's the endomorphism ring over K of the exterior algebra on V, and so it's a matrix algebra. But it's important here that the quadratic form is non-degenerate, because if the quadratic form were zero, then the Clifford algebra would be an exterior algebra, and that has infinite global dimension.
So again, exterior algebra doesn't depend on the dimension of the exterior algebra.
No. If there's at least one variable, the global dimension is infinite. No, even one. The exterior algebra.
Oh, it's
zero. But the example I wanted to give is you take G, a finite group, you take K, a field of characteristic zero, and you take the category of modules over the group algebra of G, so where KG is a group algebra over G with coefficients in K. And which result is this? So I didn't write down the result. So the global dimension of this category is zero. Well, you can reduce it to it, but to reduce it, you need some other result first. Yeah, Mashke's theorem, right? Mashke's theorem says essentially that for a group algebra in characteristic zero, it behaves like linear algebra. Every exact sequence splits. That's one way. Every exact sequence of G representations, because that's the same thing as a module of the group algebra, splits. Equivariantly. Or, as Mashke's theorem is usually pronounced, is, for example, every subrepresentation has a complement, which is the same thing as to say, if you have an inclusion of one representation into another, then this is a split mono. So that's just saying over here that any exact sequence of representations of a finite group over a field of characteristic zero, well, here you have an inclusion, so that splits, thus the exact sequence splits. Now, what Adam was saying is how do you reduce this to example two? Well, one way is say it that KG as an algebra is isomorphic to the direct product of the endomorphism rings of the irreducible representation. Well, each of these factors here is a matrix algebra, just K linear endomorphisms of some vector space. So each of these has global dimension zero by example two. And, well, if you take a product of rings, then the global dimension is the maximum of the global dimension of the factors, which is basically just saying that if you have an exact sequence of modules over a product of rings, then you can see it over each of the factors separately. But so you see, what this shows is that, for example, to establish something as of global dimension zero, each of these is a very deep theorem. Very classical one in the case of groups. Well, for the Clifford algebra, it really involves the structure theorem for Clifford algebras. And which one, other one do we have? Yes. So the global dimensions for these rings up there, that goes even far beyond those and includes, for example, Hilbert-Syzygy theorem. So, in the not to my knowledge. No, sorry for that. So, categories of global dimension zero are essentially pretty well understood. They are just really nothing than variations on this linear algebra. So I mean, you can say that finite group representations is not exactly linear algebra, but you can essentially reduce it always to questions in linear algebra. So the next quite interesting class is, what are the categories of global dimension one? And these are called hereditary. I have no idea why. Whoever came up with this adjective hereditary, I have no idea. And they are not quite classified yet, but almost. So there's, for example, there's a recent paper 2 years or so ago by Edwin Wrighton and Michel van den Berg in the Journal of the AMS. And I believe it's 2002, plus or minus epsilon, where they classify all these well, unfortunately, you know, that would be, it's a bit too much. All these that are Neisserian. In other words, if you have a sequence of sub-objects in any object, it becomes stationary. Satisfy fair duality and are ex-finite. So I should say they classify all these that are ex-finite over some field. So let me just say a little bit about these notions. And I'll give you some concrete examples in a minute. But let me just give you a rough idea of what these things mean. So first of all, over some field K. So we'll look for an abelian category A, such that A is a K category. So K, your favorite field. And let's start from the back. X finite means, remember, what we said is that X1, A, XY, will be a K module. Right? The extension groups inherit the K-linear structure. So it makes sense to look at the dimension of these guys over K as vector spaces. And so X finite means this is smaller, is finite. So for all X and Y. And fair duality, that's a pretty interesting one in this case. It says that the functor where we take x1, and now let me do it like this. So for each y and a, and where star is just the k-dual, remember, each of these are k-vector spaces, so you can take the k-dual. And what do we get here? We get the functor, which first of all is defined on the opposite of the category, but because we dualize later, all the arrows get reversed again. So this is a functor from your category A into the category of K vector spaces. And what you want is that this is representable. This means that the category satisfies fair duality. And what does it mean in concrete terms? In concrete terms, it means that you can write x1 a blank y dual is hom in a from some object, which we'll call tau of y, into the argument. So in other words, you have a natural isomorphism for each pair x and y. You get natural isomorphisms between the dual of the X group and some hom. In this way. So this is the same as to say this functor is representable. And the tall y is the representing object. And so Noetherian I already mentioned. And so if you have all these things, then they can be classified, and that has been done. And question is, what they're working on right now is to drop the Noetherian hypothesis. Because there are some categories that satisfy all the other conditions, but which are not Noetherian. So this is really at the forefront, and it's quite important for various questions in physics to be able to get all the candidates right here. And so that's where people are working on right now. But this sounds a little bit maybe too abstract, so let's look at some concrete examples where global dimension is one. And again, it is a theorem that you probably all know, but not in this form. And then maybe we'll have a short break. So here's a key theorem. If R is a principal ideal domain, then the global dimension of the category of R modules is equal to 1. Well, I should say smaller, is equal to 1 if R is not a field. Because if you include fields as special cases of principal ideal domains, then we already know that the global dimension is 0. And what is this? You all have seen this theorem. Well, I think almost all of it, because here I didn't require that my modules are finitely generated. It's true for if you take all modules. This is exactly the structure theorem for modules over principal ideal domains. Well, why is this so, I'll tell you after the break. So let's have a 10-minute break. Yes?
If you start at the bottom left corner with Z2,
yes,
and you take your element 1, and you go over to Z8, it has to go to 4, I think.
Yes.
So then you go up to Z4.
So I still messed it up?
Well, I think if you take the same seat, but you go downwards, and you from Z4 to Z8, you just sort of do the inclusion.
Then it'll
work.
Okay, good.
In other words, your errors are going to be going downwards, I think.
All right. Okay, fine. Yeah.
Then I think that works.
Good. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I messed this one up, yeah.
You don't have
Thank you. to understand the content of this theorem, especially what does the structure theorem for modules over principal ideal domains have to do with the statement of global dimension, that needs a little bit of work. And before I do that work, I want to give you some more examples. So take Q, the quiver, and let's say, to make things nice, so what is a quiver? The quiver, we can think of just being the following data. So you have a set of vertices, and a set of arrows. Or, if you like, this is nothing but a finite category. But the key here is that there are no relations among morphisms. In other words, for example, if you have a quiver like this, then you think of it as a category which has three objects and which has basically the arrows as defined here, but the morphisms, there are a few more, right? We have the identities for each object, which one usually doesn't draw because they are there anyway. And of course, you have two compositions. Let's say this is A, B, and C. You have two compositions which are also not drawn, namely you have CA and you have CB, and they are free in the sense that there's no reason to assume that the two would be the same. So there are so in other words, the morphisms in a quiver are just all the paths of arrows, and there are no relations among them. So if you look at such a quiver, then you can look at the representations of the quiver in some field K. And so I explained what such a quiver representation looks like and what it is. So it's basically that at each vertex you assign a vector space, and to each arrow you assign a linear map between the corresponding vector spaces. And then the fact is that the global dimension of the representation category of a quiver is at most one. This has this particular case, the one where you have just one vertex and you have a bunch of loops. So let's say L1, L2, up to Ln. So n loops. And then the representation category of this quiver with coefficients in some field K is the same, well, it's actually equivalent to the category of modules over the tensor algebra K x1 up to xn. So you have n free variables, non-commuting. And so this includes the statement that for any tensor algebra over a field, the global dimension is at most one. More precisely, it is one unless the number of variables is zero. But you have other nice such examples, and they can be quite complicated. If the quiver is finite, yes. And if you take finite dimensional representation. Yeah, maybe I should say this, thanks for the question. So if you have B inside A is an abelian subcategory, then the global dimension cannot go up, right? Because to say it's a subcategory means if you have extensions of objects in B, then it's especially an extension in A. So if all n extensions in A are trivial, then they're also trivial in B already. And that's why global dimension goes down or cannot go up if you pass to the subcategory. So in particular, this means that if you look at the yes, but I mean it's a full abelian subcategory. In other words, the morphisms between two objects when they are in B is the same as the morphisms in A. But I know what I see what you're saying. Yes, let me see. Because you could have conceivably that in this equivalence relation you have things popping up where the middle terms are no longer in B. That's true. So let me try to. Yeah, I mean by full abelian subcategory, you should have. It should be extension closed. In other words, well, this is of course stupid notation, but let's say like this. So if you have an exact sequence where X and Y are in B, then this should imply that Z is in B itself. That's sometimes called extension closed. So full abelian extension closed. Subcategory. Then this statement is correct. And the application is, so here we talked about all modules, and here we talked about all quiver representations, but if you restrict, for example, here to finitely generated modules, or here to finite dimensional quiver representations, the same result is true. So finitely generated modules over a PID, or you take finite dimensional quiver representations, then the global dimension of these categories is also at most one. And strictly speaking, the structure theorem for modules over principal ideal domains is usually only done for finitely generated modules. So it is really this statement here that for the finitely generated modules you have global dimension one, at most one, which is a structure theorem. But it's also true for all modules, but you need to work a little bit harder. I wanted to elaborate a little bit on this example to give you a bit more of a feeling of how such extensions look like and how they are constructed. So what is an extension? So let's say we have V and W, two representations of a quiver Q. And I want to give you an explicit description of X1 VW. Now, for this, I need a remark, and that is to say that a morphism, and maybe I made this remark already earlier, a morphism, let's say A from V to W, well, first of all, what was that? Remember that this was an, you can think of it as a natural transformation of functors. Think of the quiver representations as being the functors on your category Q with values in the K modules. So, and this is a natural transformation. So in other words, for each vertex, you got a K-linear map between the corresponding vector spaces, and for each arrow, the diagram commutes and that's what a morphism between quiver representations is. And so the key facts here are that A is a monomorphism, a mono, epi, or isomorphism, if and only if this is true for each AI. This holds for each AI. And if you take this for granted, then we can write down what it means to have an extension of V by W. So what is an extension 0 W, let's put it X here, V, in the representations of the quiver. Now, that means, first of all, we have morphisms, like indicated, and so the, such that this is an exact sequence. Well, so this is an exact sequence. Let me call E. So E is exact if and only if the corresponding sequences of vector spaces are exact. So is an exact sequence of vector spaces for each I. Now we know that exact sequences over vector spaces, they split. Linear algebra, global dimension of vector spaces is zero. So how could such a, so in other words, we know, so this is a remark aside, it follows, so this implies that Xi is isomorphic, if you like, to the direct sum of Vi and Wi for each I. But if we have an arrow in our quiver, then we must be given linear maps between the corresponding vector spaces. And that's sort of where the non-trivial structure comes from. Namely, how will this look like? So you're assuming you're given the two ends, and you ask yourself, what can happen in the middle? Well, because over each object, the sequence is exact, so Xi can be identified with the direct sum of the outer terms. So let's write down what this is in terms of a matrix. So we have a morphism from Xi to Xj, and I'll write it in a matrix form. So Vi plus Wi, and here we have VJ, VJWJ, and so I'm just looking at how this morphism could look like. Well, you see, what happens to WI, to the direct sum end here? Well, under X alpha, it must go to WJ, and it must coincide with the map W alpha. So in other words, the matrix must have this shape. On the other hand, if I project down to VI, it induces the map V alpha. So in other words, up here I have a map V alpha, and here I have something arbitrary. No. At least there is no condition from this commutativity of this diagram here implies that X alpha is of this form. So star commutes implies that X alpha written as a matrix has this form. Conversely, the converse is also true. In other words, I put anything in this lower corner, and I just make sure that the diagonal blocks are the given maps, and I have a zero in the upper right corner, then this makes this diagram commute. So in other words, what I have is that one extension are in one-to-one correspondence with what? Well, this element here is an element in the K-linear maps from VI to WJ. So I claim it's a direct product over HOM K VI WJ for each arrow from I to J. Of course, I can do this for any arrow, right? This was for the arrow alpha, but I can do it for any arrow. Now, conversely, you have to show, and that's linear algebra, if you have So what is the x in the middle? It's a representation. So you are giving something on each vertex I. And you give linear maps, and we figured that the linear maps have to be of this form, and there are no compatibility conditions between the morphisms because we are just we impose none on the arrows. So the one extensions are precisely these guys. Now, what is X1? V to W. Now, I have to divide out by the equivalence relation. And what is the equivalence relation? Well, the equivalence relation was that I had the identity here and here, but I could have some arbitrary isomorphism on the XI. So what does that mean? The equivalence so if you think of this, what is an element here? An element here is a family of matrices, X alpha. Well, not X alpha. Let me write it. Let's call this thing something here. XIJ. Right? So in terms of the... No, it would be XJI. Right? So the J's row, I's column. So it would be these matrix blocks down here, one for each arrow. And what's the equivalence relation? Well, the equivalence relation comes basically from the choice of the splitting of for each of these exact sequences. So what I claim is that XJI alpha is equivalent to X prime JI alpha if and only if there exists matrices We'll call them maybe yi, which is an automorphism of vi, and zi, which are automorphisms of the wi. Yeah. So in other words, these are invertible matrices of the size, square matrices of the size, the dimension of vi, respectively of the dimension of wi, and these two are equivalent if, now let's see, wj is was there, so you have that zj xji yi inverse equals xji prime for all alpha. So it is like simultaneously, you see, to write it down, the morphism X alpha in terms of a matrix is, well, you can think of it in two ways. It's the same thing as to choose a basis for the each of these vector spaces Xi, which is compatible with the direct sum decomposition. Now, of course, you can still change the basis here and to change the basis here to get a different matrix representation. But this change of basis is precisely saying that you replace this matrix here by multiplying with an invertible matrix from this side or from that side. So that's precisely this equivalence relation here. And so the upshot of this is, no, they are just automorphisms. So the yi would be an automorphism here, and zi would be an automorphism here. And similarly, zj is an automorphism here, and yj is an automorphism here. No, you see, what it means is that if you were to write v alpha as a matrix, it would change by these base changes here and here. Right? But I don't really care. So you could say, I think, I'm not sure I understand your question correctly, but if you were to choose a basis for VI and VJ, then this would be some matrix. Right? If you change the basis in VI and VJ, well, this matrix would change indeed by yj from this side and by yi inverse from the other side. Right? But the key here is, if you see that in this representation, we don't really care about these two morphisms. What we care about is this block down here. Yes, but this was just to interpret this. But we also need to understand, sorry, we get back. So if we have now, we have one extension like this, so where x corresponds to this family xi and x alpha. And we have another one, yeah, sorry. What does it mean that the two are equivalent? Well, it means that we have identities here and we have some morphism here. Now, alpha is already gone, so let's call it phi. So what does that mean? Well, this means this morphism is given over each vertex. So how does phi I look like? So phi I is a map from xi prime to xi. And if you try to write this down in terms of matrices, now I think I hope I get myself through this. So if you think of this as being VI plus WI and VI plus WI, what is the form of such a matrix phi under the condition that it induces the identity here and here? Well, it simply means it's a square matrix such that it is the identity from VI to VI. So here we have the identity matrix. Here we have the identity matrix. And again, anything that comes from W gets mapped to W, so there is a zero up here. And we can have anything we like down here. Well, let's call it phi twiddle. So that's the form of the map phi. Notice that it is automatically invertible, right? Because the inverse is just given by minus phi down here. So, in other words, these morphisms phi, they are in one-to-one correspondence with morphisms with this family phi tilde from I, which is in HOM VIWI. And of course, you get one of these for each I. Yeah, so that looks better. So, what does that mean? How can we describe the extension? So here's a proposition. So given VW two quiver representations with values in our favorite field K, there is an exact sequence of vector spaces where at the right end we get what we are interested in, now we have said that each such representation can be realized through this bunch of matrices, and because our quiver is finite, whether we take the direct product or the direct sum doesn't matter, usually it's written the direct sum, so for each arrow from I to J can have a matrix from VI to WJ, K-linear map, and the equivalence relation is given by these morphisms phi I tilde, so here we have a direct sum over all vertices of the quiver, HOM K VI WI. And you sometimes this call is called DVW. And so this is this family phi I tilde in here. And how does it act on the matrices XJI alpha? So in other words, what is this map here? Well, yeah, so we were given so this is going to be V alpha and W alpha, and let's see, so phi was a map from VI to WI, so V alpha is a map, I have to, from VI to VJ, so we can go with phi tilde j to wj, so it should be like this, or we could go with phi I tilde from here to wi and then down to with w alpha, so this is phi I tilde, so for each alpha. Now the interesting thing is, what is the kernel here? Well, you see, what does it mean that all these expressions are zero? So the kernel, this means phi tilde is a morphism from V to W. So it's a morphism of representations if and only if dvw of phi tilde is zero. So in other words, the kernel are just all the homomorphisms in the category of Kruger representations from V to W. And that means that this is a very concrete way of calculating these groups. It becomes basically linear algebra. You have a bunch of matrices, one for each arrow, and you have an equivalence relation, which is basically given, if you like, by a commutation. Here you have a family of matrices, one for each vertex, and this morphism is, if you like, just taking the commutator of phi tilde with the sequence of matrices in here, the sequence of matrices V alpha, W alpha. In particular, we can easily calculate dimensions. Namely, if you look, so this is an exact sequence of vector spaces. So what do we see about the dimension of X1 from V to W? Well, it's of course the alternating sum of the dimensions here. So what's the dimension of this term? Well, here we have matrices of size dimension of VI times dimension of WJ. So this is the sum over all arrows, dimension of V, and just to remind myself where it comes from, I can also say this is the vector space V, which sits at the source of alpha, times the dimension of W at the target of alpha. Target, or sometimes also called the head of alpha. And then sometimes this is called, yeah, I should, sorry. So it's either source and target, or sometimes it's called the head and the tail. You make up your mind. As you see, I just didn't confuse myself here. So here's the source, the target. So this is a dimension here, minus the dimension of this one. And what's the dimension here? Well, here you see we have a vector space of size dimension vi times dimension wi, and for each vertex. So minus summation over all vertices, dimension vi times the dimension of wi. Okay, so that's, you have this dimension minus that, and then we have to add plus the dimension over k of the homomorphisms in the representation category from V to W. Now, it allows for a slightly better interpretation if we bring the homomorphisms, the last term, over to the other side. So, and also we switch the signs. So we take the dimension of the homomorphisms, and I'll just write rep, from V to W minus the dimension of X1, VW is equal to these terms which only depend on the vector space dimensions. So one for each arrow, and of course I got the signs wrong. This is plus summation Now you see that the right-hand side only depends on the dimensions of the individual vector spaces. And so if you say dv is a function from q naught into the natural numbers which to a vertex assigns the dimension of the vector space at vertex I, and similarly, of course, dw, then you see we can think of these as the dimension vectors, so-called dimension vectors, of V respectively W, and these are elements in the maps from the vertex set to the natural numbers. And just because things get a little bit easier, if you can also think of sort of dimension vectors as functions, simply integer valued functions from Q naught to Z, where each entry is non-negative. And then you see what we have on the right hand side is a quadratic form on this abelian group. Namely, if we have X and Y, two elements, sort of virtual dimension vectors, virtual in the sense that the entries could be negative, then we define the sort of bilinear product of X and Y to be summation over I and Q naught, XI, YI, minus summation over all alpha from I to J, XI, YJ. So this is a bilinear, is an integral bilinear form. And in particular, you get a quadratic form out of this, where you take x equal to y. So this is then just summation over I xi squared minus summation over alpha from I to j xi xj. And this is the so-called Titz form. So it's a quadratic form, and the associated symmetric bilinear form is, of course, xy plus yx. So this is sometimes called the Ringel form. This is just the associated bilinear form, bq of x and y, which is the same as xy plus yx. And if you look at the sort of, you have a standard basis, so the matrix of the Ringel form in the standard basis of ZQ naught, in other words, just take all the vectors which have one in one coordinate, zero in the others, is called the Cartan matrix of the quiver. Because it definitely only depends on the quiver and nothing else. But what is the upshot of all this? Why do people care so much? Well, look at this upstairs. If, say, the Ringel, the bilinear form is less than zero, what does it mean? Well, it means that you cannot just have Homs, right? Because that goes is the positive contribution. So this implies that the x1 from V to W is definitely non-zero. So it gives you an indicator of whether or not two such representations have non-trivial extensions. Moreover, if you take V equals W, in other words, you study self-extensions, then, well, we have that the Titz form, Q of D of V is this. And so that is if this is if this is less than less or equal to zero, then it implies that x1 of the self-extensions is not equal to zero. And why do you get some slightly better estimate here? Because you see that the homomorphism space or the endomorphism space of V with itself is clearly not zero, because it contains the identity. So in other words, you know that the positive contribution is at least one. And so if this is not positive, then it means that there must be non-trivial self-extensions of V by itself. Now here's a remark aside. sort of which are the cases where this fails? Well, if Q is positive definite, this means that you cannot a priori conclude that you have non-trivial extensions. Well, and assume that Q is connected. In other words, between any two vertices there is some path, not necessarily of all arrows going in the same direction, but they are connected by arrows. Well, what's the conclusion? Well, Q looks as follows. Well, I shouldn't draw arrows, sorry. No, sorry, let me use a different blackboard. Let's say Q bar is the underlying graph. So in other words, we'll take away the arrowheads and tails, just use the wedges, and then the continuation is that Q looks as follows. It either you have n vertices, n greater or equal to 1, and that's called a curve of type AN. Or it looks like this. Again, n greater or equal to 4 vertices. The reason is because if n equals 3, then it's a special case of this. That's called of type DN. Or it looks like this. Let's type E6. Or it looks like E7. In the last case, of course, is Yeah, so I did miscount my vertices, yes. So there should be 6 vertices. Yeah, 5 plus 1, 6 plus 1, and 7 plus 1. And that's it. So the tits form, if the tits form is positive definite, then, and the quiver is connected, then the underlying graph looks like that. So these, of course, are the classical Dinkin diagrams or Dinkin-Coxeter diagrams. And so these are the ones where you have few extensions. So that's where you can sort of the structure of the extensions is somehow encoded, partly encoded in this tits form, and the tits form allows you to classify the underlying quivers. And so how to read this is, you see, it's only the underlying graph that is specified by the quadratic form Q. So in other words, the actual quiver, you can put orientation on the arrows any way you like. So the result here is that if you have a quiver with positive definite tits form, then the underlying graph is Dinkin, and it does not depend on the orientation. The quiver, by definition, consists of directed edges, right? So, but for example, in the case of A2, you could have either this orientation, or you could have this orientation, or you could have them all point into the same direction. That doesn't matter. No, of course, you have to have arrows. And one. Not more than one. That's right. Yes, part of this statement is that between any two vertices, there's at most one arrow. Again, one can give this as an exercise, because you see, this is just graph theory. I'm just given a graph, I defined a quadratic form on it, and I'm telling you if the quadratic form is positive definite, then it must be of this type. By the way, and maybe I'll allow myself, what happens if Q is positive semi-definite? Well, then it can be either of these, or it can be a completed Dynkin diagram. And these are the so-called Euclidean diagrams, or sometimes also called complete Dynkin diagrams, and they are usually denoted by a tilde. So you can have one more vertex for each of these, but the position of the vertex is prescribed. You cannot put it somewhere. Only one spot where it can put. So for any other quiver which is not either Dynkin or Euclidean, the quadratic form is not positive semi-definite. In other words, it takes on negative values at some dimension vector. In other words, there must be representations which have non-trivial self-extensions. So let me maybe state this. So if Q not positive semi-definite, this is equivalent that there exists some vector such that Q of D is less than zero. And now this needs a bit of work. You can even assume that all the entries are non-negative, such that X1 rep QD DV is not zero for some V whose dimension vector is D. And why is this important? And I'm just going to say that and not write it down. Because assume you are looking for, remember, maybe let's look at, we looked at the case, let's say D4. And let's look at it in this orientation. Well, remember how we interpreted this. We interpreted this as a three subspace problem in some vector space. Because aside from sort of some degenerate cases where you have some vector space, say at this vertex, with a map going zero so that this doesn't see any of the rest of the graph, the critical case is where you have your three vector spaces, V1, V2, V3, V4, and each of these morphisms here is an inclusion. And then types, the sort of the isomorphism classes of given representations, when you fix the dimension vectors here, was finite, because these three vector spaces can be put into normal form. If you write it down in terms of matrices, you can find two suitable bases for V4 so that these are given by a nice position. Now, if you are in the sort of non-finite situation where you have, for example, non-trivial self-extensions, well, this simply, what it basically means is that here you can create too many new objects which just sit in the middle of two such given ones. And they destroy the finiteness. So if you want to have a quiver which has only finitely many isomorphism types of representations for a given dimension vector, you better have that the form is positive definite. Because if it's not, then there are self-extensions, and these self-extensions give you infinitely many non-isomorphic pieces in the middle of two such vector spaces. Now, I'm not saying I proved this, but I'm just telling you, and that's sort of the relation why between the classification of modules and classifications of extensions. If you have non-trivial extensions, chances are usually you find infinitely many. See that the dimension vector of the object in the middle depends only on the dimension vectors on the two sides, right? Because the dimension here is just the sum of the two. But you find infinitely many isomorphism types because you have infinitely many, you have non-trivial extensions. Okay, so now, last few minutes, let me go back to the principal ideal domains. Now, what's a typical property of a principal ideal domain, or a way to state the structure theorem? Well, here is a claim how one can state it. If one way of stating it is that any submodule of a free R module, so R is a principal ideal domain, is free. What does this have to do with the probably more familiar form you know? Well, let's assume M is a finitely generated R module. Well, what does it mean that it's finitely generated? It means that there exists a surjection from some free module of finite rank onto M. Right? By just pick a generating set and map one copy of R to each set, so map the I spaces vector to the I generator. Now, what does this property mean? Well, this property means that you know that, well, this is a morphism, so it has a kernel, which is an R module, but the statement here is that this must be a free module. So it is of the form R to the N, for some n. I'm glossing over the slight complication that a priori we need to prove that if m is finite, that then n is finite. But principal ideal domains are Noetherian, so whatever this module is, it's finitely generated. So it's another free module of finite rank. And so that means that any finitely generated module over R is the co-kernel of a matrix. And that's the principle, the structure theorem for principle over principal ideal domains. Yes? Now let's see what this helps us in terms of X. Well, I claim that this fact means that X over the principal ideal domain are very easy to calculate. And the reason is the following basic fact, true over any ring. So, lemma, if R is any ring, then in the category of R modules, any X which has R in the first component is zero for all n greater or equal to 1. This is not even worth the proof. It is just restating what this is. What is an element in here? Throw in your X here if you like. Well, it's an exact sequence which ends with a surjection onto R. Right? The elements in here are classes of n extensions. But hey, we have a surjection onto a free R module. Well, that always splits. Because take one, lift it to a pre-image, and there's your splitting. So any n extension of R by X splits. And that's just the fact that all these groups are zero. Now we know that the X sub biadditive functor in each argument, so if I put here a number of copies of R, that doesn't matter, it's still the same. So, now that means that if I are given M and N, say R modules, and just for the sake of it, I'll assume that M is finitely generated so that I can continue with this example. So M finitely generated. Then let's calculate what is X1 over R from M to N. Or, for that matter, all the extension groups. Well, we have an exact sequence. 0 goes to Rn, goes to Rm, goes to M, goes to 0. Thus, we can write down the long exact sequence where we put this exact sequence into the contravariant argument. So how does it look like? Well, it goes 0 goes to Hom over R from M to N, goes to Hom over R from Rm to N, goes to Hom over R, Rn to N, goes to X1 over R from M to N, goes to X1 over R from R to the M to N. And if I write down sort of the pieces in the general row, say, I have xi plus 1 of R from M to N goes to xi plus 1 over R from Rm to N, and the piece before is xi over R Rn to N. Well, this little observation up here says this thing is 0, this thing is 0, this thing is 0. So it first allows me to calculate the X1 as a co-kernel of two sets of morphisms. And what is this? Well, this is just n to the power m, and this here is n to the power n. And what's the map in between? Well, if this is a matrix, whatever, A, then this is just the matrix A transpose with where the entries act as multiplication on n. We had this kind of consideration some time ago. So you see that this X group is just the co-kernel of some matrix. And looking further down, you see there's the X group which sits between two zeros in an exact sequence, which means that this must be zero. So it follows that X I R M N equals zero for all I greater or equal to 2. Now, because I started with this exact sequence, I did it for M finitely generated, but you can drop this and you think of M and N as infinite, possibly infinite sets, and this is possibly free modules of infinite rank. It's still true, and there's still the same argument works through, and so this is why the global dimension of a principal ideal domain is at best 1. No? And so to finish for today, let me just sort of bridge this to Hilbert Syzygy theorem just to understand how this relates and can be seen as an extension of the structure theorem for principal ideal domains. So here, for example, Hilbert's Syzygy theorem. Well, first, I want to make one remark. You see, if we have our lemma above, we could have strengthened this slightly as follows. If P is a direct summand of some R to the I of some free module, so i.e. some free module, then X I P blank over R is zero for I greater than zero. And it's the same argument as before, because remember that X is compatible with direct sums in each argument. So if P is a direct summand, then it means that this is P plus Q. This lemma up there says that XI of P plus Q is 0, but then XI of P must be 0. And so such a P is called a projective R module. So these are the ones, these are the modules, the other direction is true as well, that kill in the first argument all the higher X. Now let's assume you have a ring R and you have some ring and M some R module. And let's try to mimic what happened for the principal ideal domains. Well, we can do that, right? We start with our module M, We choose a generating set, and we choose a free module which maps onto M. And so I just write it now formally correctly. So this is just a free module on basis the set I naught. Now this thing has a kernel. So I can do the same thing, just choose a generating set for the kernel and map onto from a free module. And I can keep going. Right, let's call this K1. Then I'll take the kernel of this map, K2. And doing this means that there results an exact sequence of this type where the rightmost term is that I'll give module and all the other terms are free modules. Now let's assume what was the thing which helped us or which allowed us to conclude for principal ideal domains. It was basically saying that everything stops after step one because the kernel already is free. There is no reason to go on further. So let's assume we have a ring which has the same property, but it is normally too much to ask for that all the modules are free. That holds for principal ideal domains, but it's unnecessarily strong. It would be enough, for example, what happens if one of the syzygies, and so the KIs are called the syzygy modules of M, if one of them is projective. Well, I claim that for the purpose of calculating the X, I can stop right here. Because if I look at the corresponding, if I want to calculate X M with values in N, I can do it inductively by chasing through this sequence, and the only thing I care about is that these terms here are all projective. And it will, if this is so, then it will follow that XIMN equals 0 for all I greater than N, right? This is the nth syzygy, and all covariant arguments N. Same proof as there, just a bit more chasing by induction. What does that mean? It means that if you happen to have a ring such that no matter which module you take, after at best n many steps in this procedure, you end up with a projective module, then the global dimension of the module category is at most n. Well, obvious. And that's exactly what Hilbert proved for a polynomial ring. He proved that if you have a polynomial ring in n variables, and that's why it's called the syzygy theorem, if you start computing syzygies, then after the number of variable many steps, you end up with a projective module, no matter which module you start with. Thus, the global dimension is at most n, and to establish it at equal n, well, you just need a pair of modules such that the xn is not zero. That's a different story. No, projective. Well, for a polynomial ring over a field, but it took another 90 years to establish this theorem by Suslin and Quillen that said that over a polynomial ring over a field, every projective, finitely projective module is free. So there is no, it's like over PIDs. Like over a principal ideal domain, we didn't have to bother because the statement is that any submodule of a free module is free. What Quillen and Suslin proved in the mid-70s of the last century was that the same thing holds over a polynomial ring. Any finitely generated projective module is free. This was a conjecture by Serre, which took 20 years to kill, but it was done. And so over a polynomial ring, yes, indeed, the statement is that after n many steps in constructing syzygies, you always end up as a free module. But that's not important for the result. All right? And so not so surprising, given what all the things I told you, you say that the global dimension of the ring, R, is smaller or equal to n, if and only if, by definition, each, and so I use old-fashioned terminology, each chain of syzygies terminates with a projective after at most n steps in this sense here. And by the way, what's the name syzygy? Where does the word syzygy come from? Huh? Exactly. Syzygy comes from the Greek, and it means this thing. Do I know the English term? So if you had two oxen and you put them under a bar, right, to keep them in line while plowing your field. That's the Greek word which underlies a syzygy. Right? So you know these things, right? Well, where you put your two oxen. And in astronomy, it means the alignment of three stars on a collinear three stars. And so you think of this syzygy is aligned with the module M in the short exact sequence. That's where the term comes from. Okay, thank you very much. See you next week. Well, yes, you didn't. I said I will prove it, but I didn't say today. Well, what I described is essentially a free resolution, but if you allow yourself to relax this and just use projectives, which is good enough, then it's called a projective resolution. Oh.